Looks like we got a good crowd, and wish you a good morning. Thank you for coming to Carroll, to Carroll County. Town Hall exists first and foremost for the constituents of the 4th District to hear directly from their representative. We thank you for submitting your questions, and we'll get to as many as we can in the hour that we have. We're going to put these questions and ask them by the county, the citizens of the county first, and then the district second. You may see me lining up and shuffling through the questions. That's mainly to put them by organizing them by topic. We'll draw the questions and then ask you if you have the question to stand up and read the question. We want to thank you for taking this time on Saturday to attend this town hall and hear directly from Congressman King. We look forward to a civil and free discussion. And now will you stand with me and so we can say the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
I want to thank Adam for supplying the donuts and the coffee this morning. We normally don't have that at a town hall, Adam, so appreciate that. Steve King grew up in a law enforcement family in Storm Lake. He attended Denison Community High School, where he met Marilyn Kelly, whom he married in 1972. The Kings have lived in Kyron since 1976. They have 3 grown sons and 8 grandchildren. King started King Construction in 1975 and built the business up from one bulldozer. He served in the Iowa Senate for 6 years and was elected to Congress in 2002. King now represents the 4th Congressional District of Iowa. He believes the Constitution means what it says and that it should be read with the intent of our founding fathers in mind. King is never caught without a copy of the Constitution in his coat pocket. Please welcome 4th District Congressman Steve King.
You know, I know it's an official meeting in Carroll County when I hear the cowbell. And there's one other place in the district that happens, and a lady comes in and does say, "Ought I introduce you to?"
Yeah, what county is that?
I got to think. It's up northwest. It's one of 2 or 3 up there, but I'm not exactly sure. But I just really appreciate you coming in this morning, and I know that everybody's got a lot of work to do, and we've had some rain this week that slowed some things down. So I got in last night from Washington, and going, what all is going on is this. First thing on the front of my mind is what's going on with trade. And the my position on this is that, first of all, with NAFTA, I never would open NAFTA up. It was good for Iowa, good for Iowa agriculture, it was good for Iowa manufacturing. But the president had made that statement throughout the campaign, and I didn't think that either Mexico or Canada would negotiate with the NAFTA treaty. They did. And so we have a handshake on that, but we don't have it finalized. And to get that done and get it done quickly is going to be hard to do. We keep getting messages back. It would have been a lot easier if we hadn't lost the majority in the House. Nancy Pelosi has no record of accelerating trade agreements. And so I expect that she's going to continue with the path that she's had. And I can't promise you that I think we get it done. And I think we get it done this year. But I don't think we get it done in short form. I think it's the long form instead. And probably after Labor Day is the most likely on that. So that holds up a lot of pork exports that would otherwise be going to Mexico. And some of our producers say that'd be worth at least $10 a ham to U.S. hams going into Mexico. And it adds up to a lot of millions of dollars for this neighborhood. That hurts us. You know what happened to the grain markets, what happened with corn here in the last few days especially. And that takes us over to the Chinese, which we just got the notice that yesterday the president kicked up the tariff on about $200 billion worth of Chinese goods. And that signaled that they didn't get a deal agreed to, even though our trade people went to China the end of the last day of April and their people came here up until about yesterday or maybe even this morning. That doesn't mean that the trade negotiations are over, but it sure doesn't make it look like we're going to get this thing done in the short term again. And I am very troubled by that. That's starting to add up. And a lot of you have said, we have to do something with China and the trade agreement with China. I agree, especially with their theft of our intellectual property, which is somewhere between $300 billion a year and $600 billion a year. I mean, it's a stunning amount of theft of the creativity of America. And the Chinese, they don't have a creative culture. America has a creative culture. That's what is one of the things that's put us at the front level in the world with our economy the way we have. But the Chinese are four times our population, and if they can steal it as fast as we can create it, you know, what do we do to stay number one in the world? And eventually, that swallows us up. So that is the central piece of this. And how you define it, how you police it, these are all things that are talked about behind the scenes, not very much about that comes out in front of the scenes. And I'm in communication with Peter Navarro and Larry Kudlow. They're a little bit of a competing group there. Kudlow has been a friend for a long time, White House chief economist, and he's a free trader. But he had to swallow kind of hard when he stepped into that White House job as chief economist and accept that the president and Peter Navarro are using tariffs to negotiate and get to free trade. That is what Kudlow assures me, that they're working towards free trade. And that's what he says Navarro is ready to do too, but we have to get there. And so I'm feeling more and more pressure from all of you on this, and I've tried to keep my messages as strong as they can in support of the president's negotiating position and still make sure that they understand. So I'm having those conversations behind the scenes as strong as I can. That's on trade. The immigration side of this thing is another great big issue, and it really is a crisis on the border. We've never seen anything like this. Our laws are being exploited, and we're not in a political position to fix them for reasons that I think most of you know. We can go into that in more detail if you like. But with the numbers that were coming across the border, a high number for a day just struck me, 4,117 illegals interdicted at the border and processed and turned loose into America. And we have shipped them, illegal aliens, to all of the 50 states, to the destinations of their request in many cases. So I just took that 4,117 and I thought, what does this really mean? What's the magnitude and the scope of this? If that's a single day, well, it's about half the size of Santa Ana's army, for one thing. But it takes 24 weeks like that, 24 weeks of days like that, to supplant an entire congressional district. So I wrote an op-ed on that and put that out about 3 weeks ago just to get it into the dialogue of the country so people start thinking about what that means. And that's a high number, but that doesn't include those who came in undetected. And the undetected numbers, it's some of it's guesswork, and that guesswork, just like I said, the range work on the theft of IP between $300-600 billion with B dollars a year, what percentage of the people that are sneaking into the United States across the border are interdicted? That number, we've had testimony before the House Judiciary Committee that from the Border Patrol that says 25%. Other testimony from the Homeland Security that says that they're interdicting only 25%. Homeland Security has testified they're interdicting maybe a third. When I go down to the border and I ask them, they'll say, well, 10% has to come first. But there's other estimates out there that say that around 55 to 58% are interdicted. I can't think that number would be that high. But in any case, if you just say half, you can take the legal numbers then, or the counted numbers then, and double them, because for every one that is brought into America, entered America illegally, and is registered and turned loose in America, there's surely one other one that we didn't interdict on the way in. And so when you start adding up these numbers, it gets stunning in its totality. But we have about 100,000 coming into America every month legally, and about 100,000 coming into America illegally, roughly another 100,000 then illegally, and that would be, I think, a lowball number. So that's 300,000 a month. And that's, would be 3.6 million, what would that number be, 3.6 million a year? That's a big number coming into the country, 3.6 million a year. And I put this into the equation of what happens with our electoral effect in Congress with redistricting. Census coming up for the 2020 census. An average congressional district is 710,000 people. And so there's kind of an, I guess I'll say, a consensus number. It's not mine, but I'll just accept it, that there are 6 congressional districts in California that are comprised that are comprised because of the illegal alien population in California. They get 6 more electoral votes, and we have here in Iowa the 6 electoral votes, 4 House and 2 Senate votes. And so there are 23 states in America that have less representation, equal or less representation in the United States Congress, House of Representatives, than the illegal representation from California. That's how bad that is. And I think those are lowball numbers. And those numbers will go up with this census because we count all people. The Constitution says count the people. Wherever the intent was to count American citizens, I'm confident that's the case. But if you're going to count Homo sapiens, whether they are legal, illegal, here on a visa overstayer. By the way, I didn't put that visa overstayer number in here. The visa overstayer number on an annual basis is around 750,000 people every year come into America on some type of a visa and don't return back home again. And so this country is just filling up by the millions of people that don't have an adherence to our laws, respect for our laws, or to our, and their representation for non-citizens is growing in this country, and the subsidization for those non-citizens is also growing in this country. And we don't have a means to stop it at the border today. As hard as the president has tried, we're in a political conundrum. And, you know, I've worked this for a long time, and if I'd had my solutions, if I could have sold those solutions back 10 years ago, we would not be in this condition today. But it's a big problem for America. So that's 2 things along the way. A third one would be the flood situation. And we had a supplemental appropriations bill on the floor yesterday. And it's one that they put too many bells and whistles in it for me to be happy about voting for it. But I voted for it because we need the relief. And what's going to happen, I believe, is that the Senate's going to take a lot of that junk out of there that was plugged in for political reasons and strip it down and send it back to us. And so we'll see what happens. If they don't succeed in that, then the president may veto a disaster relief bill. And if that's the case, then we start all over again. If we do that, it'll be the third try, because the Senate shot one down about maybe 4 or 5 weeks ago because it had too much Puerto Rican relief in there for the president. And so that's some of the things on my mind. And I want to make sure there's time to hear from all of you. And I know we don't have a lot of questions over here this morning, but what we'll do is we'll address them, and then we can go open to the floor and hear what you all have to say. So, Wilson, it's yours.
You bet. Got a question from Dr. Alan Innerberg.
Yeah, welcome to town.
Thank you, Doc.
You didn't mention, of course, I'm maybe traveling in a little different circle, but I would say the top campaign is on health care, to try to keep it freedom for both the parents, the patients, and the doctors, instead of, as Senator Grassley labeled it when he was here 2 weeks ago, if the Democrats get their way next year and win the election, it'll be Medicare for no one, and we'll return to Venezuela, where they can barely scrape up a Band-Aid today as we speak. So I wonder if you could speak on the health care issue, what you could do, realizing that the Republicans are in the minority and that you did yeoman's job when I spoke to you 3 or 4 years ago on abolishing Obamacare and replacing it, but that didn't get too far. And so where do we go from here?
Well, first I want to say that it sounds like Grassley's using more colorful language than I do when he describes this.
Yeah, and he was good.
I wanted to get that on the record. He always makes it clear and you can understand him. And I did a breakfast with him a couple of days ago, and when he got done talking, he walked back to the microphone and he said, you know, just because I'm yelling doesn't mean I'm mad at you. Which is classical Grassley.
He doesn't raise his voice much.
No, and I say of him, I've worked with Chuck Grassley for a lot of years now, and you know, usually when you're the more you see somebody, you see some flaws along the way, and you, you'd be adjust to that. But Chuck Grassley, the more I work with him, the more I respect him, and the better I like him. Yeah, he is a one of a kind and an Iowa original and a precious asset to this country. He's very, very versatile on topics, and he covers everything. So that's my commercial for Chuck after I dinged him just a little bit for his colorful language. but anyway, here's what I have done on this is, as Doc says, is that I brought the first legislation to repeal Obamacare. I slept about an hour and a half that night, and that must have been the time that Obama was signing it into law, because they hustled it right out to the White House and signed that bill. And I got up and I drafted the repeal. It's only 40 words long, and it ends up with, as if such bill had never been enacted. And that specific and precise legislation has four times passed the House of Representatives. Those people that say that Steve Kaine never gets anything done, and I'm not responsible for what they don't do in the Senate or what a president doesn't do, and I can't even be responsible for 435 members of the House of Representatives, but I drafted that legislation, I introduced that legislation, it was my brainchild, I drove it, and it's passed four times in the House of Representatives, and components of it have passed another 59 times in the House of Representatives. So that makes 63 different full or partial repeals of Obamacare that I brought forward. Now, we got some of it done. In the tax reform bill of December 2017, we stripped out the individual mandate and gave you back your freedom. But the problem with the individual mandate, there are a lot of problems with, but one of them was there were 20.9 million people in the country that were compelled to buy Obamacare insurance with after-tax dollars. And by the way, this federal government had never compelled anyone to buy a product that was promoted or produced by the federal government before. And so this was an entirely big constitutional, I'll say it, an unconstitutional leap. But that sets it up for where this may go. And I want to say about some of the things we need to do. But where this may go is this, that Attorney General Ken Paxton of Texas filed a lawsuit against the remnants now of Obamacare and contends that it is unconstitutional. I do agree with him. There are something like 11 other states that joined in that suit. And in the federal district court in Texas, the court upheld the suit of the Attorney General of Texas to essentially nullify all of Obamacare. There's no severability clause, so if any of it goes, it all goes. And I remember this. Do you think we can get a cup of coffee while we wait for the audio? Thanks, Jim. That's pretty good. Just when the engine goes by, we're good though, right? We can talk now? This will go, this court case, will go to the Fifth Circuit, Fifth Federal Circuit, and then be heard there. Whichever decision gets made out of the Fifth Circuit, thank you, Jim, then it will go to the Supreme Court. So Obamacare is, I believe, on its way to the Supreme Court. I had this discussion with Attorney General Ed Meese here on about Wednesday night. We had a good long time. He's a living, breathing icon, and at least the last active member of Ronald Reagan's cabinet as former Attorney General. He has such clarity of mind and so much history in his head. It's just a rich time to sit there and talk to Ed Meese for about 2.5 hours. But in any case, we discussed how this would go forward. My sense of that, I don't want to quote him in public, so my sense of that is that not this June, but perhaps a year from now, we will see Obamacare come before the Supreme Court, or before then, and get a decision. If that decision is that it's unconstitutional, and Chief Justice Roberts has put himself in a position, can you all hear? You okay? Okay. Chief Justice Roberts has put himself in a position where it's going to be very difficult for him to try to uphold Obamacare. And so I think that they're in that place where we're going to see it be found unconstitutional. And I think Democrats have come to that conclusion too, because they have essentially given up on trying to fix it or restore it, even though they have the majority, and moved towards Medicare for All, which I understand from you, Doc, that Grassley says is Medicare for None. And that makes sense to me because of the dollars and the quality of health care that has to go down if the dollars aren't there. here's what I want to do, and here's what I hope we can do. I want full deductibility for everybody's health insurance premiums. If employers can deduct the health insurance premiums for their employees, if you're a corporation, you can do that for yourself and your employees. But those 20.9 million people, that a lot of them are mom-and-pop operations, family farms, buying health insurance with after-tax dollars being non-deductible, that's just wrong to put that many people in that position. So that's one thing. The second piece of it would be the tort reform legislation, which I did draft and introduce and passed off the floor of the House in the previous Congress. That's another one of those, King doesn't get anything done, here's another bill. The tort reform legislation, it's modeled off of California, actually. And California Governor Jerry Brown signed it into law in 1975, and he just retired as governor. But it's upheld very well in California, and it limits the liability, but what we call them is punitive liability, as opposed to, it makes everybody whole, but it limits the amount that can be paid just to send a message. So if somebody spills some coffee in their lap or whatever, it doesn't get to be an $8 million deal. It just fixes you for your coffee and a fee. But anyway, we capped it off of Californians and passed it off the floor of the House, sent it on Mitch McConnell's desk. That's another piece that it seems to me that number was $5.4 billion annually was how it was calculated, as how much money that would save out of the health insurance industry. And then another one is selling insurance across state lines. That's Paul Gosar's legislation. And to be able to purchase insurance from other states, it would still have to pay in the state you're in, the resident you are. There's conflicting opinions on that, but I can't find anybody that says it hurts. And it may help a lot in some states. So those are all pluses. And then we also have legislation that expands health savings accounts. And I did the calculation back when Medicare Part D passed and health savings accounts, that if you take a young couple at age 20, and if they started maxing out at their $5,150 a year that they could put into their HSA, spend $2,000 a year out in just normal health care costs, and then compound the interest at the 40-year rate, whatever that number was, just to get a standard, they would arrive at Medicare eligibility rate 65. That is 45 years, and not many people are going to have that kind of continuity or the ability to max out. But they would arrive under those numbers with $950,000 in their health savings account. And so then, at the time, they could have. At the time we did the math, and you have to do it in current actuarials, the liability for a couple going on Medicare would be $144,000. So theoretically, at least, and I mean actuarially, they could buy a Medicare replacement policy at the time we did that math at $150,000, leave them $800,000 in our health savings account. That's just an example of what could happen. So we went in and more than doubled this in the legislation so that you can actually put more dollars into this. But what it would do is it would let people opt out of Medicare if they purchased a replacement policy that would be paid up for life with that $144,000. Keep the change tax-free, $800,000 under those numbers. That turns this health savings account into a life management account. And you get to build your own retirement. If you have a good health experience, you build a retirement plan. And you would be have an incentive then to get some exercise, watch your diet, get your checkups, take care of your health, because you'd have that retirement plan on the other end of it rather than having somebody take it away from you all the time. So that's one of the things that I hope to be able to do. Insurance across state lines. Oh, the reimportation of prescription drugs is another one. And the medical malpractice piece and full deductibility. All of those things would put us back in control of our own health. And then if Supreme Court throws this out and pulls Obamacare out of the books, which I expect will happen, then a lot of members are talking about what we're going to do to, see, they were talking repeal and replace. And I think we did a good job in Iowa before Obamacare passed. And I'd rather have those decisions made by Mark and his successor rather than by the people in Washington, D.C. who think one size fits all. We did a good job here in Iowa. We had pre-existing condition provisions. I had oversight of that when I chaired the state government committee in the Iowa Senate. And yes, premiums were high, but boy, they look cheap today. So there's my part of my answer, Doc. But if you have a follow-up, I'll listen to it.
We locally on the Republican Central Committee sent passed unanimously a resolution and sent it to the head Republican to get you back on a committee. For God's sake, you're a fountain of knowledge, man. I mean, it even snows this old brain under listening to you. For God's sake, if we can't get you back on the committee, this country's gone to hell in a handbasket. Yeah. And I don't want to get to swearing, so I'll pass.
Okay, but I will speak to that and respond to it, Doc. And you all ought to just, you're all interested in this, you know. This is, man, there's all kinds of injustices that take place in the world, so I can't tell you it's the worst one. But I've never seen, there's no place in history that I see that Congress has ever sanctioned anyone for expressing a freedom of speech outside the chamber of the House of Representatives that was a misquote in the New York Times that the president has said time after time, the lying New York Times. I didn't say they lied. I didn't even assign them malice. I just say it's a misquote. And we've proven that it is in every way possible. But it was a political lynch mob, and you have to let their blood cool before you can reason with a lynch mob. And so I have let their blood cool, and I put together a 6-page document, a fact-check document, that if it's possible to prove something didn't happen, which is some people say is it's illogical to think you can, there are a number of solid points in there, but one of them is this, that we said, We signed up to LexisNexis, which searches everything in print as far back as you know, current times anyway. So we went back to the year 2000, and we asked it, has Steve King ever been quoted as ever saying those two odious ideologies, which are in that quote, which are white nationalist or white supremacist? And so we searched that from 2000 on up until the end of 2018, and the answer is no, never. Never any derivative of those terms either had I ever been quoted ever even saying those terms. And then we said, but to be objective, the other term in that quote is white is Western civilization. And I speak of Western civilization. And so we did that search. I had been quoted 276 times in that same period of time saying Western civilization. So if I were having this kind of discussion as they would put in the New York Times, surely those words would have shown up someplace else out of those 276 other times that I've been quoted using the term Western civilization and defending Western civilization. And the next piece of that is, then Kevin McCarthy says, well, I have a video of you doing an interview with Dave Price, WHO-TV in Des Moines. I believe the date was October 20th of last fall. And Dave Price asked me, what is the definition of a white nationalist? Well, I don't really have that very well in my head because I don't trade in that language or think about it or know people that do. But I started out to try to define it. I said, well, first you'd have to be white. I'm trying to figure this out as we go. And then I said, but then, well, Rachel Dolezal didn't have to be black to be black. So I guess maybe you wouldn't have to be white. I'm just buying time. And then I said, but it's a derogatory term. It may have meant something different 1, 2, or 3 years ago, but today it means racist. That was my answer. Now, I don't know how that turns out to be some kind of an indictment to give an answer like that, but I went back and did the research on it too. It seems to be an argument as to whether it had a different meaning 1, 2, or 3 years ago and somehow may have turns into some other word in the minds of Kevin McCarthy. So we searched that in LexisNexis. And was it even used in political dialogue? From the year 2000 up until 2016, even the term white nationalist was virtually unused. That means 1 to 200 articles a year in all of America, or even a blog, was it even mentioned? Only 1 to 200 times in all of the publications that are out there. Then in 2016, it went up to 10,000 times. And then 2017, 30,000 times. 2018, it was used 20,000 times. I didn't realize how precisely correct and accurate I was. I was just an estimate when I gave that answer, but it's really clear the left has weaponized these terms, and they have plugged them into these quotes, and they're using them against me, and Kevin McCarthy, in a knee-jerk way, decided that he could virtue signal and at my expense. So his mind has to be changed. and I'm about out of patience. Don't expect me to sit around till the end of this Congress, till this appointed time has been served, and then get out of the penalty box after the next election. This is going to get pushed pretty soon. I want to do it the nice way. I want to do it a different democratic way, but some way or another, this is going to come to a head, and it is because it's wrong, and they jumped to a conclusion. I never had an opportunity to even speak to my colleagues about it in any kind of open forum like this. They haven't heard from me even like this. That I did on the floor of the House in a limited amount of time while our blood was up, and that's it. So that's my answer, Doc. We're gonna get something done some way. It's got to happen.
You could suggest to Brother McCarthy that if he wants to talk to somebody that's known you and worked with you and supported you for 20 or 30 years, that I can be quoted in the damn newspaper, I'm not bashful, that you're not I've never known you as a bigot, a racist, or a radical white supremacist, whatever the hell that is. And back on the medical question, I graduated from Carroll High in 47, 48, and my claim to fame is playing down in Iowa City on a couple of state tournament basketball teams, but I was also on the debate squad. And you know what the statewide topic in the debate was in 1946 and 7? Socialized medicine. And I was on Gannett, and we won. And I've been fighting this damn battle for 75 or 80 years, and I've still got a little fight left in me, and thank you for all your help in Warson. Even though they screwed you, I can't believe that they took the best congressman and took his committee assignments away from him. But your administrative assistants ought to have plenty of time to whip up a good bill or two.
We're going to dig through six pages
keep
of that.
Freedom medicine for the patients and doctors, or we'll look like Venezuela. I can guarantee you that.
I want our freedom back in a lot of ways.
Right.
And on another thing I would add on this committee piece and this throughout this campaign. That was going on. We did in the last 3.5 weeks, building up to the election. We did 27 events altogether that we organized and or that I attended to support the Tanzanian Miracle Kids. And a lot of you, most everybody in this room, I think, will know that story about saving the lives of those three kids that were the only three survivors out of 38 on a bus wreck in Tanzania.
Yep.
And I had the privilege, and I just say it was a gift from God to give me the opportunity to forge one link in that chain of miracles without which those kids would be dead today. They came back to say thank you to all of those that lent a hand to save their lives. Jeff organized a bunch of meetings for them. Andre Easter out of our Okoboji area organized a bunch. And I went to a number of them. We took them even down to Des Moines to raise funds for the organization that runs the orphanage and the educational school in Tanzania. 27 in the last 30 days, all the time they spent probably $2.5 million in that same period of time calling me a racist. And on top of that, there's not a single person in all of that Congress that I've served with now for 16 plus years, on and off committee, including people like Maxine Waters and Sheila Jackson Lee. Not one person would ever stand up publicly, has ever, I don't know what they would do, has ever stood up publicly and said that I have ever treated any of them in any kind of a disparaging or disrespectful way, no matter what their race, no matter what their gender is. I don't have a single accuser except Kevin McCarthy. And he jumped to a conclusion for whatever reasons he has. So thanks, Doc. We worked it pretty hard here, but I appreciate
you. Speaking from your heart.
There's fight in you yet.
Well, you throw out those figures, it just snows under this 90-year-old brain. But I absorbed a little bit of it.
I think you got it all. What do we have next, Wilson?
We've got another question on the same topic.
Okay. Hi.
Gene Ludwig, Carroll County. I wanted to support you in your response about that newspaper article, because I was interviewed by that same person. And the article was printed on the day of the election. And he was asked, you know, they're very nice in talking to you. I was recommended by Doug Burns to be talking to this fellow who was a friend of his. And so then he said, well, what do you think about nationalism? Well, you know, putting your country first. Okay, so, you know, they lead into this very, very evenly. So what do you think about white nationalism? I said, well, I don't know. That's your term. So they're trying to take the conservatives and nail them with this sword of word that they're using to call us racist. So I just wanted to let others know that this happens all the time, and it's not just to you.
Thank you. And I didn't realize that there were people out there that were being set up in that same fashion.
Mm-hmm.
What I said is that I did make a mistake. I should have never done the interview. And it was a 56-minute interview, no tape. He didn't have a tape either. And there's no transcript. And he won't say what question it is he even asked me that I was responding to. And so that's they are. They're trying to pull that out. And now if I talk to anybody in the press, I have to record everything. And yes, and one of the things that I've gone by in the past that has served me pretty well is if I don't have an ability to record, I make sure I don't say anything that I haven't already said to the press before. But that didn't work this time. And so, and there's it's not the only story that's false. There are a number of other stories out there that go back through this, the history of this. Like, for example, there's a Washington Post story that was published October 25th that says that I duped a Jewish group to fund my trip to Vienna to plot, anti-Semitic and pro-Nazi moves. That's in this story of the Washington Post. And I just, I didn't need that this time. I was just going to hit the punchline. But that's in the story of the Washington Post. And when I paid my way to that meeting, it was a businessman that I've known for several years. We've done a number of meetings in Washington. He said, when you get close to Vienna, come in. I've got some people I want you to meet. And it was about a download from me on the economy and politics in the United States for business people in the Vienna area. So I bought my plane ticket to Vienna, flew down and paid for my hotel room, and out of my kid's inheritance, I like to say, because Jeff's in the room. And then when I sat down, I was introduced to these five people I didn't know as they came in the room. We sat down at the table. And then, during that pause of who's going to talk first, the gentleman on my right said, Congressman, I think you should know that you're seated at the table with two homosexuals and a Jew. And man across the table said right away, well, who's the Jew? And that told the rest of us he knew who the other homosexual was, I guess. But I tell you this because nobody's doing any neo-Nazi, anti-Semitic plots with homosexuals and Jews at the table. It's the most improbable configuration of people possible, but they smeared that all over and turned it into a huge pejorative attack on me that was pretty much equivalent to the New York Times. That's what is going on, making things up, and as soon as they put it in print, there become actually thousands of stories out there. Every blogger's got to write one, and it used to be that when something got printed in the paper, it went in ink, got sent out, and you could call up the editor and get it corrected, and then in the next edition, you'd get the correction, but it's impossible to correct because with the internet, everything is replicated in real time, and so once something goes out that's false, it's just everywhere. We have to figure out how to discern truth from fiction, and it will end up tearing our country apart. And that's, thanks, that kind of winds me up too on that. I've got more, but I stopped. I disciplined myself. What, what's it?
Yeah, Todd Kenny, you had a question.
See, I know that the fuel Iowa contingent was up. You see this week, Leo and Glenn and petroleum marketers, not fuel Iowa.
Oh, yeah, okay.
What's the latest with the biodiesel tax credits and RFS?
Well, I can only tell you that what we're dealing with is the RIN waivers that have just gotten completely out of hand. We got our E15 rule out for year-round E15. That would be something that's right in front of you, I would think. And it looks to me like that rule will go into effect. But the 2 days after Wheeler, the EPA administrator, published the rule, which was sooner than I thought he would, 2 days after that, then the EPA issued five more RIN waivers. Now it looks to me like there's could be I mean, I'm getting a little bit different numbers, but I had some conversations this week, so I'll just plug them in here. I haven't seen them in print. Maybe as many as another additional 2 billion gallons worth of RIN waivers is on the books, either approved or on the way. I was working with 1.7 billion altogether, and then I didn't get the tally on those five, and they've issued two more since then. Looks to me like there's seven different refineries that have been granted RIN waivers, which says it absolves them from having the requirement of blending ethanol at a 10% level. And so that just takes it off the market. And if it is true, these numbers that are in my ear from meetings this week, but not yet I've seen on paper or the source, it could be as much as 4 billion. But what it amounts to is we're about a 15 billion gallon RFS requirement. So what it amounts to is that for every gallon that's waived on a RIN waiver with a small refinery waiver, for every gallon that's waived, then that nullifies the RFS by a gallon. And if it's 4 billion gallons altogether, it's at least 2. But if it goes to 4 billion gallons altogether, and it wasn't clear how many had been approved and how many were looking like they were going to be, and that's why there's discrepancy in the numbers. But say a billion here, a billion there, pretty soon there's nothing left of the RFS. That's really the bottom line. And so I'm looking at this thing in a couple of ways, and what I have is a bill that I don't have the final version yet. It's in drafting, but it's one that sets it up this way, is that whenever the EPA grants a RIN waiver, that gallonage gets added back into the RFS. It doesn't get deducted. It gets added back in, and the rest of the refineries have to blend it. And that's that pushes that thing in the right direction, and it goes back to the existing also, so it isn't from this point forward, it's retroactive to the beginning of the RIN waivers. Now, I'll get a lot of pushback on that, but it's a pretty good debate and talking point, and maybe it becomes law. What do you think?
Well, I agree, it's destroying the RFS, but the people that are getting granted the waivers, I don't know how they're picking and choosing.
But who's responsible for that leakage?
Okay, well, just a minute. I'll hear this and I'll come back to you. Mm-hmm.
So the refiners are getting the waivers, so they're probably unjustly so getting them, and it's destroying the demand and destroying the whole RFS. So I don't know who's going to end up being the loser, just big oil, major oil companies? I don't know.
Well, there's another way to approach this, and that would be to just change that word small refinery to small refiners. And that would bring us a better solution, I think, because we've got huge refiners that have small refineries that are getting waivers.
They own them.
Yeah, and they're exploiting this. And so it looks like EPA essentially hung out the shingle and said, send your RIN waiver requests here. We'll approve them in our time when we get to it, is about what that's my sense of it. And I don't like where this is going because they will nullify the RFS. So I want to put a strong bill in there that at least sends a strong message. And, you know, maybe it gets modified, maybe it gets killed off, I don't know. But it gets it into the dialogue. There's two pieces I'd like to see in there. One is just if you're going to provide RIN waivers, then find a place for those gallons to go otherwise. And otherwise, then let's go for RIN waivers for small refiners rather than small refineries. But we've been in this debate a long time. The president said one day, he said, I've had 3 meetings on ethanol. We're at war in Syria, and I've only had 1 meeting there. And this was a while back, so he's had more on Syria now. But you had more you wanted to say, though. I can see it. So.
No. What about the biodiesel piece?
Well, that chugs along the same. I'm not hearing very much. I rely on the Senate side of this thing because we've lost so much ground in the House. When I went to Washington, we had all renewable fuels were strong, and I didn't have to worry. We had bipartisan support. And since in the last, say, 5-6 years, it's gone the other way, I'm surrounded by people that are just focused on trying to squeeze out renewable fuels. And it's the petroleum lobby. It's a dream team of the lobby. There's a lot of them, and they're good at it. So, but we just don't have the votes in the House, so I try to keep the subject matter off the floor because I don't want to see a debate or a vote because we'll lose. So that's how I approach that. But I support, of course, the blender's credit for the, or the credit, the production credit for biodiesel. And it's good for a soybean market, and we make some up the road a little ways.
It's the only incentive left to use it.
Mm. Pretty much. That's much of the tax credits that we have put in, that Congress has put in place. A lot of that all happened before I ever got there, but it has developed industries that could emerge and compete. And that's true with ethanol today. It's also true with wind. And I think we'll look back on this time, biodiesel hasn't reached that point. And at some point, they need to figure it out. So I want to help them until they figure it out or it becomes clear they can't. And you, sir, you had a question or comment?
No, just to ask who is responsible for this. Is it just big oil that's just pushing this whole thing? Or?
Yeah, they're definitely protecting their interests. And, you know, I get competing stories there. They'll say big oil has been subsidized for 105 years or something. And I ask, what are those subsidies? When I look through that list that I get, a lot of them are not the best way to define a subsidy, I guess. But they definitely have those kind of benefits along the way, but it isn't as much benefit as I think I'm hearing from some of the people in the industry here. So I want to look at that objectively, too. I don't want to just pejoratively go against them because they're not our neighborhood. We need them in this country, and we couldn't have built America without petroleum. But here's one of the things that I'll just put out here that I think we ought to be inspired by, and that is in about 1912, I think it was, they had that big gusher down in Texas called Thimbletop, and they hit that, and you've all seen the picture of that huge gusher. It had a wooden derrick on it, and that oil was blowing out everywhere, probably 150 feet in the air or so, and that launched the oil industry in Texas, and they had to figure out a lot of things. One, how to control that, how to put out oil fires, how to fish for broken bits, how to drill, how to case, how to cement, do all that, and how to perforate. They've got all of this technology way beyond, and fracking is the most modern version that's really hit us. They've developed that, a lot of it, in Texas. Well, if they ever run out of oil in Texas, they've still got the knowledge base and the industrial base there. And I insist that we continue what we're doing on renewable fuels here so we can hold the knowledge base and the industrial base here as well as the production of renewable energy. We are the number one renewable energy producing congressional district in all of America when you add together the BTUs from ethanol and biodiesel and wind, that all together. We produce more renewable energy than any other congressional district, and we've got the knowledge base here. We know how to do it, we've got the technology, we've got the industry, and we need to pull more of it in. And that first hit me years ago when I walked in one of the early ethanol plants, and there was a big industrial box, a shipping box, cardboard box with a plastic liner, and I looked at it and it said enzymes. And the next word down was Georgia. And I thought, man, why are we buying enzymes from Georgia? Can't we produce our enzymes here? Mm-hmm. Yes, and we're producing a lot more here with the renewable energy in a lot of ways. Let's keep that up and make sure that when and if the day comes that we're producing all the renewable energy we can here, that we have the industrial and the knowledge base so we can market that to the rest of the world. Now, Texas does that with their energy, with our petroleum now. We are doing it with renewable energy, and we need to keep it up. That's a real opportunity for us. So. Anything else in the... Yes?
I want to follow up. Something you said was that we couldn't build America without big oil. I wonder, similarly, we couldn't have built America without immigrants. And I look around this room, everybody here is heir of an immigrant. So, and then you said we got 3.6 million immigrants coming in each year to work. And they're coming here for economic opportunities. And Department of Labor statistics says we have 7.1 million job openings. And the biggest impediment to growth in Iowa is workforce. So it seems like you're working against Iowa and against the history of the United States by being hostile to all these immigrants.
Well, first, there's no record of me being hostile towards legal immigrants. And I take an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States, the supreme law of the land, and I respect it, and the Iowa Constitution and Iowa Code as well. And that means that I support the laws that we have. And everything that I've done with regard to immigration has been focused on restoring their respect for the rule of law. And I've watched it be eroded here over the decades. And our immigration law has been enforced less and less. Ever since Eisenhower, each succeeding president has enforced it less. And this president wants to enforce it, but it looks to me like his ability, or at least the data, looks like that trend is still continuing as the way it's worked out. I would say that here's something that I've learned in this business, is that we sit down at the table to talk about what policy we want to bring forward to try to change these laws that we respect. And I'm often listening to people and I think, well, they must have answered all those basic questions, and now we're talking about how some component of it all. And then I learned that if you ask the basic questions, you might find out that nobody has asked them yet. So we ask them, and I put my staff to work on this about 15, 16 months ago, and it starts with this. How many Americans are there? At that time, the estimate was 326 million. Then what are they doing? Well, 152 million were in the workforce. That's good. That number's probably up a couple million at least by now again. But 152 million when we did that. You said 7.1 million. That was about the number we had in our chart, around 7 million for unemployment. Then how about those not in the workforce that are working age? And that was 16 to 64, 46 million Americans simply not in the workforce in that category. Some in school, some early retirees, and some of them also are homemakers. Okay, that's their choice, but out of that 46 million, there's a lot of them that could come into the workforce. Then we pay unemployment up to 74, and so those age 65 to 74, I gotta count them, put them somewhere, put them in a category, and there are 14 million in that category. And then there are 23 million that are on disability, and a lot of them qualified for SSI disability long ago. We don't go back and ask them, how you doing? Think we could put you back in the workforce? And I see double amputee veterans, combat wounded double amputee veterans going to work every day, and we're not even checking those 23 million people on disability. So I make this point that we found 107 million people in the country that are in categories from which we could hire some. And of course we should be able to hire the highest percentage out of the unemployment, next highest percentage out of those that are not in the workforce, and then on down the line, as I've said. But there are people out there to be put to work, and one of the reasons that we don't have that done is because we make it too easy not to work in this country. And what I don't hear is from all the employers out here that are trying to hire people, and that includes my own family in a condition that you've described, and maybe even more acute than you've described, we're always looking for help for King Construction, that they haven't raised the issue of, suppose we could just lower that hammock down to safety net level, towards safety net level again, and provide the incentive for more people to get off of that and go off to work. And we have yet to put together even a good policy that lets that happen incrementally for people. That's either all or none for welfare benefits. And we talk about, I haven't written the bill either, it's so complex, and it's a third rail. So I think that we need an immigration policy that's designed to enhance the economic, the social, and the cultural well-being of America. We should bring the best people in here. And we need a good, strong, effective, and efficient immigration policy that recruits the best people we can to America. But we need also to enforce the law and secure our border for all kinds of reasons. And illegal immigration is one of them, but drug smuggling is the worst one. And the terrorist side of that is a component. So, and then restoring the rule of law. That's how I look at this, and for me, you know, it's often accused that if you want to secure the border, that race is a factor. We are all created in God's image. And He gave us the ability to draw the distinctions between each other. We can tell each other apart. 7 billion people on the planet. There's no two faces the same, and about 50 billion in their graves, and their faces aren't the same as the 7 billion that are walking around on this earth. That's a tremendous creation when you think of it. And what would our world be like if we all looked the same, or if we couldn't tell each other apart by looking at each other, or the sound of our voices? I could come up behind somebody that bought a new pickup that I haven't seen in 10 years, and I know who they are by the way they sit in the pickup from the back. I mean, that's how unique we are, but still all in God's image. And so I want to start with that, restore the respect for the rule of law, do the things that are right for the economy and the system we have here in the country, And we're a long ways from that because we're at a major tug of war, and the people on the other side of the aisle are the major beneficiaries of this, but large employers and large employers, Republican employers and Democrat employers, are pressing for more and more cheap labor, and our taxpayers are subsidizing that. So I want tighter labor supply overall because I want the middle class to expand and be more prosperous. And that's an important part of America, too.
How hard is it actually to become a legal immigrant? How long does it take and how much does it cost?
Boy, those are two concise questions. What I get, if someone comes in here legally and makes a bit of a difference on what path they might follow, but I hear about as fast as it's turned over to become a citizen is about 3.5 years. And maybe a typical span of time would be more like 7 years to become a citizen. I don't know if we've ever advised anybody against getting an immigration attorney to help them through that. It's too complex, and I don't know what that cost is. But there are those who have experienced it probably here in the room that know better than I do.
When our immigrants came, mostly from Europe, they came to New York, and they basically just were able to walk in the United States, or they had a host out here in Nebraska or somewhere that took those people. I would say it was a lot easier at that time than what it is now, would seem to me.
But still, we bring in about 1.2 million legal immigrants a year into the United States. And that's why it's easy for me to remember 100,000 a month. It works out almost perfectly. And that at any given time, there are another 5 million out there that are waiting in line to come in legally. So that's, and if we expedited the line, it would probably get more people in it. So one of those basic questions that doesn't get discussed, and I don't know that I have a good answer for it, is what should the population of America be in 50 years or 100? And, you know, what are the objectives of our immigration policy? And I've described them to a degree, but we don't have a consensus in the country on what that is. So it is, of all of the questions. Healthcare is a piece of cake, Doc, compared to the immigration issue.
I got something on immigration, too. I wish the Carroll County Sheriff Pingree was here, and he could speak for himself. But we asked him at a public meeting here a week or so ago, "You've been busy." He says, "Yeah." I said, "What the hell have you been doing?" He says, "We had 3 major methamphetamine busts." I mean, major. And he says that there hasn't been in the state of Iowa, there hasn't been a homegrown manufactured bust in 10 years plus. He says, "It's all coming over that Mexican border. We need a wall." And he sat down. So I thought I'd just hand that to you. You were the original. When I was still a kid, you were talking about building a wall.
You're still a kid, Doc. Well, I did. I support your position on that and the sheriff's position on that, and that is my position on a wall. I went to the floor in about 2005, and it was as they were saying, "Oh, it's 2,000 miles long, and there's mountains and deserts. It's too hard to build a wall." Well, you know, I think all the stuff we've done in the construction business in 40-plus years, it looks like a really gravy job to me to go down there and build a wall for 2,000 miles. So I thought, I'm not able to get this through these people. You know, a lot of them, they grow up in the city, and they don't even get to see a sunrise or a sunset they don't leave the city, maybe years at a time. How do they expect that they can ever have any vision on the future if they never get to see the horizon? And so I thought, I'll make it real simple for them. Surely they had an erector set, and they can play it. So we went to the lumber yard and bought some tongue and groove, 1x6 tongue and groove, cut it up in pieces about like there, like that, and spray painted it flat, kind of a flat gray so it looked like concrete, put a little foundation in there, brought it to the floor, and took those pieces, and I just said, "Here's how you build a wall." We pull the truck up with precast concrete in it. We've already poured a slip form foundation to drop it into. We can do that with a trencher and a slip form that's made up of Gomeco and Ida Grove. And I know what it costs, too. And then we drive the truck along there with the sheets of precast concrete, pick it up with a crane, and just set them in one at a time. So I sat in each one of those and made that wall. This is all out there on YouTube, by the way. So that's how easy it is. And then people go, "Well, you know, somebody's going to come along. If you build a 13-foot wall, they're going to sell a 14-foot ladder." And I thought, well, under that logic, you know, I told Janet Napolitano when she tried that line, I said, well, okay, they might do that, but then I'm going to dig a 1-foot hole on your side of the wall, and that'll fool them. So I'm just as logical as she is, right? So then I took a spool of solder, and you pull that out like a slinky toy, and you know how that looks, and I set that on top of the walls. We'll just put up that up there as a deterrent as well. And you go down to the border now, they're making whole fences out of concertina wire. They said that was offensive to put that solder up on top there back in 2005 or 6. And now they're building, the army's down there, military's down there, and they pull out their concertina wire and stack it up 10 feet high. So, yes, the wall is cheap. And here's another thing, is that I'm the only one that I know of and that is even paying attention, but I've tracked for more than 10 years the cost per mile to defend that border with the Border Patrol, Custom Border Protection, ICE, Humvees, retirement plans, and all those things, and re-infrastructure. But my number is about a year and a half old. I need to refresh it. $6.7 million a mile every year for all 2,000 miles. Now, so think, if you go out here in the country road in Carroll County, let's say we go down by Mark's place, and you take a mile of gravel road, and if the DHS, Homeland Security, came up and said, hey, Senator Sagabar, we're going to grant you a contract to secure that mile of road, and we want to pay you $6.7 million a year on a 10-year contract. You're looking at $67 million, and you can let 75% of the people that want to go through there through, and we're still going to pay you. That's what we've got. But I'm going to bet you that if I wrote that check to Mark Sagabar, there'd be nothing get across that. He would secure it all, and he wouldn't be hiring a maximum number of boots on the ground to stand shoulder to shoulder. He'd put an infrastructure in place like a wall, and then he'd monitor it with technology. That's what I want to do. If you want to rebut that, though, I put you on the spot, Senator.
Well, I can keep my cattle in with just one wire. So I think I can lick this problem pretty quick.
Yes. And you put that wire on top of that wall I just described.
And then, the scare factor is worth a lot.
Yeah. Horses respect that, and they do too. Doc?
I can remember distinctly you talking on the floor of the House of Representatives and you hauled in those great big pictures of a wall.
Yes.
And how long ago was that?
Oh, more than 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, 12 or 13.
And the Democrats wouldn't give you a damn dollar for a wall, yeah.
Well, it took a little while to elect a president that would actually run on that. But that also brings me to this, that I want you to know how much your voice matters in this country. And we all of us that come together to get engaged in the First in the Nation caucus, whether we're Democrats or Republicans, we come in when these candidates show up and we voice our positions to them. And I know most of these Republican candidates that have shown up in the last, say, 10 or 15 years personally before they get to Iowa. So I get to see this from this perspective. But when they get up in the morning, I say it this way, when they get up in the morning and shave themselves, they see, looking back at them, the next president of the United States. That's what inspires them to come here and present themselves. But if you said to them, you have to take an indelible ink pen and write down all of your positions, all your planks, and all the platform that you would have to be the next president of the United States, it would scare them to death because they don't know all the things they want to do. They first have to know what you want them to do and then decide whether they can embrace it or not. And so when a Donald Trump stands up and says, I'm for a wall, and when you stand up and cheer or rattle your cowbell, that makes it more like, you probably even did that with him. And so that makes it more likely that's a plank in his platform. If you get the support from you, that's how the planks in the platform are selected in Iowa. And then we build that platform out of our collective voices, and we set our candidates, our chosen candidates, 1, 2, or 3 of them, we send them off to New Hampshire. And then New Hampshire usually pulls some nails out of ours and fixes it differently, but it goes down to South Carolina, and then they restore a lot of our values in South Carolina. They've got it pretty well right down there. Well, today, when I walk into the Oval Office, I look around there and I think, my gosh, we really did succeed. We really did get our Iowa values transferred from the cornfields of Iowa into the Oval Office in the White House in the body of Donald Trump. And he has, back in the war room, a big whiteboard with all of his campaign promises on it and check marks behind those that he's succeeded in. They aren't all kept, but I don't see any right now that actually have been flat-out broken and can't be kept. So I want to, that's how important our voice is here. And think what would happen if we ever lost our first in the nation status here in Iowa. It would be, I think, a disaster for the country if you handed this over to, you know, I guess I should be careful about what I say because it'll offend somebody else in the country. And but I'll put it this way. We are the best place in the world to live and raise a family. We have the best economic opportunities. Our markets are down and they're flat now. We're spending equity across Iowa. This too shall pass, and it can't pass soon enough to suit me. But, you know, the population's going to 9 billion people on the planet. We're in the food production and the energy production marketplace, and we've got a good educational system. We've got good families. We've got good churches, good communities. And we'll be fine. 100 years from now, this is still going to be the best place in the world to live and raise a family, and I want to keep it that way. I guess I ran over a little bit, but if there's a last question that somebody has been holding back, yeah.
Yeah, I've got one for you. Thanks for coming out, Congressman. We appreciate seeing you. I wanted to kind of pick up the immigration thread again. Because earlier you were talking about you know, folks who were apprehended as they crossed the border, you know, unlawfully, and then are released into the interior. Now, as I understand it, that's something that happens when someone is petitioning for asylum. Now, you described those individuals as illegal immigrants. I wanted to know, as you know, someone who is well-versed at the issue and, you know, proponent of the rule of law, is it not true that an asylum application is a form of legal immigration to the United States?
Well, I'll say...
Good question.
It is a good question.
Yeah.
And I can give you some data on how this works out. If they are granted asylum, it's legal. But here's... I sat down with the director of USCIS, and he's a holdover from Obama, but it was a good decision. He's a good guy, and he's a rule of law guy. And it works out like this. And I was a little surprised at the numbers he gave me. Of those that apply for asylum, they're trained to say the right words. I'm afraid to go back to my country because. And so then they apply for asylum. They get an asylum hearing scheduled. And we hear numbers like 90% don't show up. But as he surprised me with what he said, 60% show up for an asylum hearing. 40% don't, but 60% do. Of those, then, but 10% are granted asylum. That means actually 6%, 10% of the 60%. So 6% are granted asylum, 94% are not. But of those that are denied asylum, they are given a deportation hearing notice. And then nobody shows up for that one. So I said, doesn't this work out to be that 100% of those that come into America get to stay, whether they didn't show up for their first asylum hearing, or whether they didn't show up for their deportation hearing, or whether they were granted asylum? And he said, well, that's not precisely correct, because every once in a while we encounter some of them with ICE, and some of them eventually are deported. But that's why I think of it in that terms. It would be 94% of those that apply for asylum are denied, and those would be illegal immigrants, but they stay in America anyway. The 6% that do get asylum are legal immigrants.
Okay, and I understand that the Obama administration, you know, as recently as 2016, had an office that was responsible for making sure that individuals whose asylum petition was not granted actually first attended their asylum hearing, but then also attended their notice of removal hearing. Right? Social workers who were responsible for keeping track of the individuals who were waiting for their asylum claim to be heard. That the Trump administration zeroed out funding for that office. Is that correct?
I know nothing about that. I'd have to check and see.
I wish I could give you the name. It's just escaping me at the moment.
Yeah. What we have is, this is on Facebook Live, so my staff in Washington, D.C., they're probably looking for this right now. And that really helps.
I'll watch the Facebook page and see if it gets posted up there.
Yeah, but just ask them to do that. Sue Ann, you wonderful person, can you dig out the bottom story on that and inform all of us? And she got the message, so.
Yeah, thanks, Congressman.
You bet. Thanks for asking that. I don't get many questions that are that precise, that it's a legitimate one. And then a piece that I hadn't thought about here until the last couple of weeks, too, is how many are visa overstayers, which I brought into the earlier part of the discussion. And so I'd say 100% of the attempted visa overstayers do stay. And it's we also have, and I used to sit down with Hillary Clinton on this once a year and discuss how many refugees we would bring into America. And that number was around 75,000. And I think that's lower under Trump also, just to put another piece of data into the dialogue. So given that our clock has run out here, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate you all coming out here. That tells me that you're focused on good government. You want good, strong representation of your values in Washington. Gives me more energy. It gives me more octane in my ethanol in my tank, and I can use it. So I appreciate your support, too. And, Doc, you set a good example for all of us, and there's hope for everybody. You've got a lot of fight left in you. So thanks very much. I appreciate you all.